You're listening to the Whole Hog Sports Podcast. And now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
Today on the show, how will we remember November? Also, we'll look at the hierarchy in the SEC this season in football. First, a word from Kendall King.
Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Frank Broyles always said it, they remember November. I would do the Frank Broyles accent, but I'm not very good at that. But you know, you look at Arkansas and what they have coming up in November, and until I see differently from this team, I'm going to expect that they're going to be competitive games. They play Mississippi State on Saturday on the first day of the month, bye week. Then they go to LSU. They go to Texas. They finish the season with Missouri here in Fayetteville. And, you know, you look at all of those games, and I think you could make a case for Arkansas could win any of those four games. And I certainly don't think they're going to win all of them and go to a bowl game. That would be astonishing at this point in the season with the way everything has gone down to this point. But, you know, let's just go game by game. They got Mississippi State this weekend. Somebody's going to have a breakthrough win this weekend. Mississippi State, they're on a 16-game losing streak. Arkansas, we all know what's going on with them. Both of these teams have been awfully close. I mean, like mirror images of each other in some ways, and how they just continually find ways to lose these games. So somebody's going to get a breakthrough win this Saturday. Why can't it be Arkansas? They go to LSU. LSU, they've got an interim head coach right now. What's the belief at LSU? They're going to be coming off a game against Alabama. You know, what does that look like in Baton Rouge in 2 or 3 weeks? They play Texas. We've all seen Texas this year. Offense, not very good. Last 2 weeks, they played two winless SEC teams and gone to overtime in both of those games. Both of those games were on the road. Texas found a way to win. Give them some credit for that. But, you know, we know how Arkansas plays Texas. Every time they get together, it seems like it's a pretty competitive game. Missouri comes in here. They're down to their third-string quarterback now with Bo Perbula being out. Eli Drinkwitz's name is being floated around for all these jobs. What does that look like the last week of the season when Missouri comes in? Now, I could flip this around, and I could say the same. I could make so many arguments to say Arkansas should lose all four of those games, or they will lose all four, or maybe they shouldn't win them. You know, Taylen Green's turnovers and line of scrimmage and the secondary and all this stuff that has plagued this team at, you know, different times in the year. But, you know, I've not totally checked out on this team like I think a lot of people have, because I do think that what I've seen the last few weeks is that they're still playing competitively. We haven't seen them roll over and just take it the way they did against Notre Dame that ended up, you know, ending Sam Pittman's time here. And I guess until I see that in one of these games, you know, like if Mississippi State comes in and wins by 30 this weekend and there's no fight from Arkansas, then I say, okay, you know, I'm done. But I haven't seen that yet. There's still a competitive nature to this team. And, you know, so again, how do we remember November? Is it different? Maybe it can be. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I think I've kind of taken a similar view, but sort of the more pessimistic view of the situation.
As you would.
As I would, which is funny. I feel like you and I go back and forth. Sometimes you're the optimistic one, and sometimes I am.
Depends on the sport.
It really does. And I think I tend to be more reactionary than you. But I think when I look at this game, it feels a little bit similar to last week, where you've got two teams with a lot of problems, but somebody has to win.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I wrote, you know, we do our weekly picks for the newspaper. I've already written mine, and I picked Mississippi State, and basically because I just feel like I don't have much reason to believe that, you know, with Arkansas, it's always something, and I have no reason to believe it won't be something in this game. I think it's just become really hard to trust Arkansas. They haven't put a complete performance together against a quality opponent all year. And so, you know, like we saw last week, the defense finally gets it together and the offense falls apart. Like, I have no evidence, nothing I can point to say that I think that won't happen again or why that shouldn't happen again. It might not. it's perfectly reasonable to say it might not, but I have no reason to like believe that that's true. All signs point to, well, it'll probably be something, you know, because it always is. It has been all year. And honestly, you know, Mississippi State people could be saying the same thing because, like you said, they're so similar in that they've been so close so many times and they've had these kind of just gut punch losses. So maybe Mississippi State fans would feel the same way about, well, Mississippi State will find a way to blow it. And so maybe it's just one of those things where it just depends which side you're kind of paying more attention to. But to me, it's just this Arkansas team hasn't given me very much reason to trust that they will that now is the time that they will put together a more complete game.
When you said reason to believe, it made me think of that Rod Stewart song. I looked up the lyrics here. Straight face while I cried, still I look to find a reason to believe. I think that's where I am with Arkansas. And I will tell you, as it relates to Petrino and whether or not he could be the head coach, the fact that I think that they could potentially, you know, win a game or two in November is the reason that I haven't totally written him off. I think he hurt his, you know, his candidacy for this job on Saturday, and we talked about that earlier in the week, the fact that they lost to Auburn. But I've been around here long enough that I know that people lose their ever-loving mind if you beat Texas in any sport, and especially in football. Frank Broyles, again, second Frank Broyles reference of the show, he would always say you go 1-10, but if you beat Texas, you get your contract renewed. And there's a lot of truth to that. Yeah. I mean, think about this. Think about the last three times that Arkansas has beaten Texas. 2003, Houston Nutt beats Texas. New contract at the end of the season. 2014, not a good Arkansas team, but they get hot at the end of the year. They beat Texas in a bowl game. Brett Bielema gets a new contract. Sam Pittman, 2021. They go beat Texas. Sam Pittman gets a new contract at the end of the year. Now, a couple of those teams, they were 9-win teams. You know, Sam had a 9-win team. Houston Nutt had a 9-win team in 2003. Nebraska was kicking his tires at the end of the year. Everybody very famously remembers the Cornhuskers had a plane out here at Drake Field, and they had a pilot, you know, just hanging around the lobby waiting on, you know, what's Houston's decision going to be? Is he going to come back with us to Lincoln or not? So, you know, it was more than just beating Texas. But when you beat Texas, people, it hits different. And it doesn't matter if Texas is any good or not. Bielema beat Texas. That was a 6-7 Texas team. But you beat them, and it hits different. And so, you know, I guess until Arkansas is 0-6 under Petrino and they've lost to Texas, I'm still going to sit there and think maybe this happens just because that Texas game, for whatever reason, it holds so much weight with people. And it's not just in football. John Pelfrey's second year, they beat OU in Texas in the course of a week, Texas being the second one. And they beat Texas, and people are like, got to give him a new contract. Got to lock this guy up. And then they go 2-15 in the SEC that season, and he's fired within 2 years. But, man, I'm telling you, beating Texas, it makes people lose their mind. And if you could beat Texas, beat LSU.
I was going to say, what if that's all he does? What if that's
well, if that's all you do, then that's probably not enough. But you couple that maybe with another win.
Yeah.
I wouldn't rule it out. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that I would advocate for it. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm just saying that winning that type of game carries such weight that I don't think you rule anything out at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I think to your point, the rest of their games on the schedule are pretty winnable. You know, I think the top team they play that are in your SEC efficiency rankings, the whole team efficiency ranking, is Missouri at number 8. So everybody is in the middle to the bottom of the conference that they have left. And so I think they're winnable, but like I was saying before, it's just I have very little evidence to say that they will have it together enough to actually that things will break well, because they just haven't. And you know, you get to where it's like, okay, well, something has to go right eventually. Just law of averages, things like that. But it's just, I don't know. I have little that makes me think, well, they've got to get a win in here somewhere. I don't think they do have to. I think they could,
No, you're right. I mean, we've seen them go winless in the SEC before, where you had those thoughts like, hey, you know, it's got to happen somewhere.
Yeah.
Even if it's 1-7.
Yeah. But it doesn't
happen.
It doesn't gotta.
Yeah, no, you're right. I keep waiting for them to put together the complete performance. And I think they were so close to doing that against Auburn, or they had the opportunity to do that against Auburn.
Fourth quarter just fell apart.
I think the teams excuse me, about to lose my voice here.
I was going to say, by the way, particularly rough day. Let me just say,
well, here's what happened. We totally skipped early fall, and we just jumped straight into late fall / winter today here in Fayetteville. It's another beautiful day in the Ozarks. As I look outside the window, and I see, you know, kind of mist blowing and 45 mile an hour wind gusts, and it's cold. Auburn was a chance to put together that complete game. And I think that these teams that are left on the schedule, they more resemble Auburn than they resemble Texas A&M or Tennessee, in the sense that there's not that real potent offense that they're facing. I mean, Mississippi State this weekend may have the best offense of anybody that they've got left on the schedule. Missouri, again, they've lost their quarterback. Their run game is not as good as it was early in the season. Texas and LSU, they've both been a mess offensively all season. But now you turn the page a little bit and you say, but they also look more like Auburn defensively than some of these early teams did. You know, Missouri, they've been all right defensively this year. Texas is one of the best defenses in the SEC. LSU, we thought they were one of the best defenses in the SEC, but what the last couple of weeks have shown us is that if you have a mobile quarterback against LSU, that's a whole lot different than if you've got the statue standing still like a Cade, you know, a Klubnik in the Clemson game at the beginning of the season. Mississippi State, they've been very average, if not below average, defensively. So I just keep waiting. Like, can they put together a complete game? And if they can put together a complete game, say they put together a complete game against Mississippi State this weekend, can they take momentum from that into their next game?
Yeah.
Momentum can take you a long way.
And honestly, I would lean just on its face toward yes, because of how I've been really impressed with the fact that they haven't let go of the rope. They definitely could have, right after Pittman was fired, especially on defense and all those defensive coaches were dismissed. They definitely could have then. They could have won now that these last couple losses have come in. They could this weekend. I don't think they will. Again, that's another thing. I have no reason to – they have given me no evidence to say, yeah, I think this is when they're going to quit. Mm-hmm. They haven't quit, which honestly I've been surprised and impressed by. So that does kind of give me some reason to think that they might, you know, if they were to get a win, that maybe they could turn that into, you know, a little bit of momentum going through the end of the schedule if they were to get something this weekend.
Because we've seen them quit before.
Yeah.
I felt like they quit 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Auburn came in here and they just smacked them around.
Yep.
There was an Auburn. By the way, do you realize that Auburn, in all these consecutive games they've won in Fayetteville, the last three times they've won in Fayetteville, Arkansas's been the favorite. Arkansas's been the favorite to beat Auburn four of the last 5 years, which is amazing to me. Arkansas was favored to beat them in 21. Arkansas was favored to beat them last year down in Auburn, and then 23 and 25 here in Fayetteville. It's just weird.
Yeah, that is
how that's worked out.
That.
But Auburn's they win a lot of those games.
Yeah,
and the home team has not won in that series since 2020, when there was a highway robbery down in Auburn, when Bo Nix spiked the ball backward, and they ruled it an incomplete pass.
The way you said that made my mind go like literal highway robbery for
it
some
was.
Reason. The way you said that, my brain said, "Oh, really?"
Jason Autry and his officiating crew, they stole that game from Arkansas.
Well, and then Auburn had a game stolen from them this year, didn't they? Maybe that was the karma for that. Which game was that? Was it Georgia? And then that officiating crew has been suspended for like the rest of the year.
Yeah.
For
was it stolen from them though? They still had they were still up 10-0 when that happened.
That's
true. There's a very
that's
big
true.
Difference it's between different. That happening and if they rule it correctly in 2020, Arkansas recovers the ball in the last minute of the game,
right,
and you run out the clock and you win.
Yeah,
little bit different there. I don't know how we got to that point. My nose is itching. My throat is all over the place right now.
It's only Wednesday. We still have so much to do.
I want to talk about the SEC hierarchy because it's kind of interesting the way that the hierarchy looks this year, because I don't know that it's quite what people thought it was going to look like coming into the season. Some of the teams that we thought were going to be really good haven't been so good. And then certainly there's teams like Vanderbilt who you thought that they could be competitive, but I don't think anybody would have dreamed that they'd be 7-1 at this point. Mm-hmm. Texas A&M. Who thought that Texas A&M would be undefeated at the end of October?
Not me. I thought they were going to be kind of upper middle coming into the season.
All right. So we've got three tiers of SEC. Tier one, that's the top. Tier two, that's kind of the middle class. And then tier three, we've also called lots of tiers because those are the teams that just don't win very much. We'll start with tier three because that's where Arkansas obviously resides. Mississippi State is there. Kentucky is there. They've only won one SEC game. I would put South Carolina in this classification because I watch all the Shane Beamer's post-game press conferences. Lots of tears in those. Then you've got Florida. I think that they would be in there just based on – I know they've won a couple of SEC games.
They have.
But it's not
– It hasn't looked good when they have.
No. And nothing's looked good about Florida this year. Auburn, they're kind of – Auburn's a weird team to me because you – they've got a defense. And their defense is – pretty darn good. Mm-hmm. Third best in the efficiency ratings right now in the SEC. But they haven't won a whole lot of games. So Auburn, I kind of teeter there on them being in tier two or tier three. I think tier one is very clear cut. These are the five playoff candidates from the SEC. I would not be surprised at this point to see any of these five, if not all five of them, in the playoff. Because I think that they're all at the point now, Christina, and the teams are A&M, Alabama, Vanderbilt, Georgia, and Ole Miss. I think they're all at the point that they have done enough now that they could afford to lose a game and they could still get into the playoff, especially if it's a real high-profile game, maybe a close loss in a high-profile game. For instance, has anybody really talked about what's coming up at the end of the year between Georgia and Georgia Tech? Georgia Tech's undefeated.
I haven't really given it much thought yet, and I haven't really heard anybody else. But
Georgia Tech, and what's weird is they actually, because they could get more money out of it, they moved the game back in the offseason out of their home stadium.
Oh, I remember that.
Into Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta. So there are going to be a ton of UGA fans there. Now, probably going to be a lot of Tech fans there too, but I feel like it's going to be more of a neutral site game. That has got the potential to be a big-time game that has some playoff implications, just like last year's did.
Yeah.
But last year, Georgia Tech wasn't in the playoff talk.
Yeah.
And now they are. I mean, like it's not out of the realm of possibility. In fact, I would say that it feels very possible that you could see a 10-1 Georgia team against an 11-0 Georgia Tech team playing at that stadium to end the season with maybe both of those teams looking at going to their conference championship game the following week. Yeah. It's a real fascinating thing how that works out. But to me, that top tier is A&M, Alabama, Vanderbilt, Georgia, and Ole Miss. And you look at who the other teams are that are kind of vying for a playoff spot. You look at the ACC. Are they just a one-bid league this year? Maybe, probably, don't know. Depends kind of on Miami and how they finish the season. Big 12, I would think probably a one-bid league this year. What happens with Notre Dame? Do they get in if they run the table? But it's not going to surprise me if these five SEC teams are all thinking that they've got a pretty strong chance of getting in the playoff when that comes around.
Yeah, it's been fun to kind of track this. And I think, you know, we're talking about Vanderbilt as a real playoff contender, which is so fun. I know you and I have spent a lot of time here talking about Vanderbilt and just how impressive it is what they've
been able to do. I'm a believer in Vanderbilt.
I am too. I want it for them. I just think it's more fun when you have somebody like this that's kind of new to it and you have a team that's kind of arriving. And I think, you know, that's why part of why I like Georgia Tech so much. Now, not obviously not the same thing as Vanderbilt, but I like Georgia Tech a lot. I like how they play. I love Haynes King. And I think, you know, I don't know who's on the rest of Georgia Tech's schedule, but even if they dropped one game between now and the Georgia game, you're still looking at, you know, a huge game there.
And you're still looking at them being able to play in the ACC championship game, where if they win that game, doesn't matter if they got a loss or two losses, they can get into the playoffs just the way Clemson did last year.
For sure. So, I mean, I think it's interesting. We were talking a couple weeks ago, and you've asked some of our guests that have come on to talk about other teams about, you know, who do you feel like we have a clear picture of the top of the SEC? And I think we have a really clear picture of the options, but I still don't think we have an idea of who the one and two sort of top dogs are, even in this group. I mean, obviously you have two teams that are undefeated in conference play, so that gives you something, but I don't necessarily feel like I look at either of those teams, and Texas A&M maybe, but I don't necessarily look at Alabama and go, yeah, that Alabama team is definitely like a head above Georgia, Ole Miss, Vanderbilt. You know, like I don't necessarily look at them that way as being, okay, yeah, I can definitely say that just they are better than them. Obviously the record is what it is. But I don't feel like there's a team that you watch them and go, okay, that's a dominant team. That is the team that is the best. And that's what's been so interesting about this league this year, because you have that, you've had that so often in the SEC. And that's, you know, that's not even just an SEC thing. We're seeing that kind of across the country, and that's what's making it so interesting. You know, you've got Vanderbilt at the top of your team efficiency ratings. And they've been there all year, and we've been waiting for them to come down, and they've come back a little bit closer to the rest of the pack, but they're still not, you know, getting overtaken. I do think Texas A&M would be my number one team as far as just, I just think they are the best team. I still don't necessarily think that they are, you know, I don't feel the same way about them as we've felt about an Alabama or a Georgia team in the last few years, where they've just been clearly so much better than everybody else. I don't necessarily feel that way about this A&M team, but I think they're the best team in the SEC right now. I think Vanderbilt's up there. I think Alabama, obviously, all these teams we've been talking about. I would put Ole Miss maybe at the bottom. I kind of keep waiting for the Ole Miss bubble to burst a little
bit. Who are they going to lose
to? I mean, who's left on their schedule? Because that I don't know.
I don't think they've got a.
South Carolina,
path. Yeah,
the Citadel, Florida, and Mississippi State. So yeah,
I see them being 11-1 at the end of the regular season. I don't know that they can get to Atlanta. Maybe they can. Mm-hmm. They would, you know, if you had a one loss Ole Miss and a one loss Georgia, then Georgia would have the tiebreaker. I don't see who they're going to lose to. I think they're sitting really pretty at being in the playoff right now. And all these teams that are wanting Lane Kiffin to be their coach, like, you're probably waiting on him till mid to late December. Is that something you really want to do? I don't foresee LSU or Florida wanting to wait that long.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, I just think that the top of this league is clear who's in the mix, but not necessarily who's above. And then to look at kind of the middle here, what's interesting is I'm looking at just the straight up SEC standings right now. And we're talking about Vanderbilt as in that top five group. Texas is also 3-1 in conference play. They're 6-2 because they have that loss to Ohio State. Vanderbilt's 7-1. But it's one of those things where when you watch Texas, you don't think of them as being on the same. It doesn't look this, they haven't looked the same getting to a similar result.
They could still get to Atlanta.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's not really that.
Which is so interesting because it's like the way that,
because,
you know,
they play A&M at the end. And, you know, if you're a one-loss A&M and a one-loss Texas, then Texas gets that tiebreaker.
Yeah. I mean, it's been interesting because of the way that Texas has been talked about by us and everybody. You know, the way the royal we, has talked about Texas has been.
The what?
The royal we.
The royal we?
Yeah. Have you never heard that?
I have never heard that.
Really?
I've never been referred to as royalty. I do appreciate that.
I think, yeah, that's a thing. Yeah, I hope I'm using it right. It'd be pretty embarrassing if I'm using it wrong.
Well, you know, I do that a lot. I have a tendency of just putting my foot in my mouth and saying, I mean, I
nobody tell me. If I use that wrong, nobody tell me. But I think the way that everybody has talked about Texas would make you think that they are not in that mix, that would be a surprise. And it's because of how they've looked, because of how we expected them to look versus how they've performed, especially with, you know, the Arch Manning of it all. But I just think the actual result has been, it's been such a mixed bag that it's hard to predict, I think, their future.
So the middle class in the SEC, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Missouri, Texas, LSU, maybe Auburn, maybe not Auburn, I don't know. Maybe you can put Florida in that conversation, the fact they've won two SEC games, even if it hasn't been real pretty. It's always interesting to me to think about what we think a year is going to look like and how it actually plays out. And this is no different than pretty much any other year where it's just totally different this year than what we thought it was going to look like.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's what's been so interesting about this season, really across college football, is they're not the only team that's been surprising as far as underperforming.
All right, when we come back, we're going to talk about what we would do if we were starting college football over again. This is kind of a fun little exercise. First, another word from Kendall King.
Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King. We are Soapbox. We are ShopCart. We are Design.
They want to tell you about our friends at Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971, committed, professional, and versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas, or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. A reminder that tomorrow's podcast is going to be a roundtable discussion with Arkansas's baseball assistant coaches, Matt Hobbs, Nate Thompson, and Bobby Wernis up at the Hogs Illustrated Sports Club. So if you're a baseball fan, that'll be something I don't think you want to miss. We'll talk to them about the fall. We'll talk to them about some big picture stuff. Excited to get up there and have that conversation with them tomorrow. And then this is just like a little PSA announcement. Clocks. They move back this weekend. Oh, don't forget to move your clock back. You get to add an hour of sleep.
Yeah, I just always forget about that. But this is the good one. This is the extra hour. Good stuff.
And then it gets to the point that it starts getting dark at like 5:30 at night. That's the downside to it. But I have noticed as I've been driving my kids to school every morning, it's getting like it's a lot darker on the drive
to
school
crazy.
Than it has been. So yeah, you know, if you're a morning. You're a morning person.
I am a morning person.
You get extra daylight.
Get extra daylight, which has been really nice, especially because I run in the mornings and I don't like to run in the dark. It's not my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, running, not my favorite thing in the world. Okay, so we asked this question. By the way, did you have something about Royal We that you wanted to say?
I did look up the Royal We during our break because now I was worried that I used it wrong. I used it kind of wrong, but not super wrong. But here's what it means. It's the use of we instead of I by an individual person, traditionally used by a sovereign or a monarch. So I'm just being a monarch here. Mm. But I used it to mean we as in like a collective we, but it kind of means like referring to yourself as a we rather than like referring to like I was using it to mean like a whole collection of people.
We're like, lacking sovereignty here on the desk today. So moving on.
Grammar corner over here anyway.
We had a conversation this morning about like what would college football look like if you could just blow the whole thing up and start over again? Because the whole system just feels like it's broke. And I don't know that there's any way. Well, let me backtrack. There are ways, I think, to fix it. But it's a way that nobody wants to go there because it involves making players employees. It involves probably unionizing the players. Lots of things like that. That you know, college leaders they don't want to get into that. And honestly, we're in the situation that we're in right now because college leaders they didn't want to get into that. They didn't want to make concessions when they could make concessions, and now everything's being forced on them. You know, through the courts and other things. And so, like, what's broken about college sports? How would you fix it? To me, I would say, number one, the first thing that I would do if I was a college sports leader, and it's hard to be out there, like you know, if you're hiring someone this offseason and trying to be the maverick, the cavalier that's going to do this, I think the number one of the very top problems is the way that we view head coaches and that there's always this fear of I'm going to lose a head coach. Like, okay, I understand it. You know, if your head coach is Nick Saban, but there's very few coaches, in my opinion, that are out there that if you lose them, it's going to set your program back forever, especially if you as a leader feel strongly enough and confidently enough and convicted enough in what you believe someone needs to have, the qualities that they need to have to lead your program. Like if I were an AD right now, the whole, what we've thought about in terms of hiring coaches and you know, what they should possess, all of that I feel like is backward relative to where the sport has gone right now. It's always been, okay, we're going to give them till their fourth year, their fifth year. You're going to get a 5-year, 6-year contract, you know, but long term, we really hope that you're here for 10, 15 years. That's all backward. To me, it's about winning now. Like, and that's what all these firings this year have told us. It's about winning now. I mean, Brian Kelly, you didn't win enough right now, and now you're gone. James Franklin, you were in the semifinals last year. You lost 3 games in a row. You're out. So if I'm an AD making a coaching hire in this offseason, I would be looking at somebody and saying, What can you do for me right now? And then with that in mind, it would also fix the buyout piece where, okay, I'm going to hire you to a 4-year contract, but I'm only going to give you 2 or 3 of those years guaranteed. But to make up for what you might lose in a buyout, we're going to make you the highest paid coach in the country. We're going to give you $13, $14 million up front. And so you're going to get your money, but you're not going to be saddled as an athletic department with $40, $50, $60, $70 million buyouts whenever and trying to determine, hey, is this going to, like, how do we do this whenever it comes time to let that coach go? By the way, did you read the story that LSU was basically like passing the hat in the luxury suites at the game Saturday?
No, I didn't see that.
Like, okay, yeah, can you give $1 million? Can you give 5? Are you good for 2? Like, they were literally in the suites kind of coming up with a game plan.
That's
for
crazy.
Like, this is how we're going to pay for this whenever it inevitably goes down tomorrow.
That is crazy.
But the buyouts, fixing the buyouts, I think, is corrected if you go into this with a different way of thinking about how you hire your head coach. It's no more, you know, you're not thinking that you're going to have that guy who's going to be there for a generation anymore. It's about, hey, who can win right now? And how do we put ourselves in the best position to win for the next 2 to 3 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the coach salaries and coach compensation thing is a big part of it. I think they've just become so inflated and the buyout situation is so difficult. And schools are doing it to themselves, but then it's become such a trend that it's hard to kind of dig your way out of it. But I think, you know, before I get into what I was thinking, I do want to mention, and I don't know if I've ever told you about this, but this is not an ad, but there's a podcast, sort of a podcast series called Who Killed College Football that I really recommend. And they go through kind of different sort of things that have kind of gotten us where we are. So they talk about coaches and like coach contracts. They talk about TV executives and sort of how we got where we are with the state of TV. They talk about how the NFL has influenced some of how college football works. And they kind of, each episode they treat it like a suspect, and they kind of go through like how this thing got us here. And it's really, really good. I definitely recommend it. And it taught me a lot. But I think when
so
I
it was
like
it was Greg Sankey and the study with the
yes,
candlestick.
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
So I think when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, you know, not how do we, like you said, not how do we fix how it is now, but how could we have even avoided getting into this in the first place? Like, the toothpaste is out of the tube now and you can't put it back in, but how could we have maybe not unscrewed the tube to begin with? And so to me, I actually think there is a world that is not that different from the world that we are in right now where it actually worked out really well. I think we're close because I think, you know, I am supportive of players making money for NIL. I think that's a good thing. I think that should have been happening all along. What happened was the NCAA couldn't enforce anything that it wanted to enforce, and it got sued a whole bunch. And basically, that allowed for the collectives and the pay-for-play structure to come up. They could not properly account for that. They could not properly prevent that. And so to me, it's like, and I don't know what this would look like practically because you know, a lot of what went into that was various lawsuits. And so if I could say, all right, nobody's allowed to sue me and here's what I'm going to do, it would have been allow for players to make money off their name, image, and likeness, literally off of their name, their image, and their likeness, selling their jersey, all that kind of stuff. That's great. That should be happening. The problem became that coupled with the transfer portal at the exact same time, the collective structure, the pay-for-play structure, and the opening of the transfer portal at the exact same time, pretty much, that got us into a lot of the situation that we're in. I'm not even anti-transfer portal. I think you should be able to transfer. I'm okay with people not having to sit a year. I think, you know, transferring multiple times, maybe you should have to sit a year. And I agree, you know, whenever we would ask Sam Pittman about this all the time, he would always say, go to one transfer portal window. Stop doing the post-spring practice transfers. I agree with that. And it seems like that's kind of where we're going. You know, we're going to have this January window this year. And so I think if you do one transfer portal window, you can transfer one time without penalty. I think after I still think that after one, you should, you know, maybe have to sit. And then I think being able to make money off of your pure name, image, and likeness is fine. You know, revenue sharing, I don't think has to be bad, but I think that if we didn't have this as much of a problem with the pay for play situation, we wouldn't necessarily be in the situation we're in with revenue sharing.
Get players contracts.
Yeah.
Give players contracts.
Yeah.
That fixes this. Now, there may have contracts. To be like, you know, some sort of collective bargaining that could potentially.
Well, and that's there you get into the employment part. And that's why employment is the answer to all these problems. And nobody likes it, but that's why employment is the answer.
Does it have to be, do you have to be an employee? And I don't know. Do you have to be an employee, though, to say, okay, you're coming to play for us and you're going to make a 2-year commitment. And if you only want to stay for 1 year and you want to break that commitment, you owe us X number of dollars?
I kind of think so.
Okay.
Because I don't know how else you really enforce it. I think the collective bargaining is important. I think that's why the NFL functions the way it does. You know, I think people are upset about the idea of professionalization, which makes sense. But, you know, I've read people say that, write this in various columns before. It's like, but this isn't professional. College football is not professional because it is unprofessional. Mm-hmm. It is run
in so many
poorly.
Ways.
You have people's barbers who are their agents. Like, literally, that's a thing that I've dealt with.
Really?
Yes.
A barber?
Yes.
Hmm.
What? You know, and that's, you've got, whereas in the NFL, you have, you know, you have to get licensed as an agent. There's things you have to do. You can't really have that. And another problem with college football is it's so big. There's so many teams, so many players, so many different levels. And so that does make it harder. You can't just copy paste NFL model onto college football. It's very different, but you can get closer, and they're not really anywhere close right now.
It's a weird world. You look at it and you say, well, it's kind of like the NFL, but then it's not. It's kind of like Major League Baseball, where you've got the big markets and the small markets, but it's really not, because there's, you know, it's not nearly as regulated. I don't know how you fix it. I think that the way you do fix it is that you do have the employment piece. But, man, I mean, that is the undertaking that would require is just almost beyond comprehension.
It's possible it would create even more issues, and issues that we don't foresee and wouldn't know how to solve. So I don't necessarily, it's, you know, a silver bullet that would just solve everything. I do think it would set you up to fix a lot of the issues people have with how this is playing out, but it could definitely create problems too.
I don't know how you fix it. And until you fix that, I don't know how there are a few teams that have figured this out, how to be competitive in this era, year in and year out, but there's a lot of teams who haven't. And even like some of the teams that you would expect, hey, you know, they're going to figure this out, you know, like an LSU. Well, you know, and maybe it was as simple as they made the wrong head coaching hire, but LSU, is there a team out there that is more equipped than LSU to be able to do this? I wouldn't think there's a whole lot more. You know, Southern Cal, look at them. You would think that Southern Cal, that would be a team that now they're equipped to Michigan. And there's so many of these, you know, quote unquote blue blood teams that haven't figured it out. And then there's all these teams that you look at them 3-4 years ago, look where Vanderbilt was, look at where Indiana was, look at where Georgia Tech was, and they have figured it out.
They're making it look easy.
Have they figured it out for, you know, just like a year or two? Have they figured it out long term? We don't know that yet, obviously, but it's so hard to really just wrap your mind around how much this is or just what this looks like. How do you fix it? But I go back to, I think it begins with making players employees. Mm-hmm. And that's that is the most seismic, if that ever happened, it would be the most seismic shift that has ever happened in college sports. We talk about rev share and how big of a deal that was for the NCAA, and, you know, probably the Supreme Court case in 1984 was the only thing that was even nearly as big. Both of those would totally pale in comparison to making players employees. And then, you know, that there would also be another kind of mental shift that would go into that. Look at the NFL. The head coaches, they ain't anywhere near your highest paid employee.
Yeah.
They're way down the list. Your defensive end, your quarterback, your number one receiver, your shutdown corner, those are the guys that you pay. And I don't know that college sports is anywhere near ready for
that
type
of
thought shift.
I don't know how you would make that happen, because you would have current sitting coaches making a ton of money. And I don't think, you know, I mean, who is the highest paid coach right now? I can't think of who it is off the top of my head.
I would guess it's probably Kirby.
That's what I was going to say. Okay, that was going to be my guess.
I think he's, what, like 10, 11 million a year?
Yeah, something like that. So you're not going to, you know, say tomorrow they said college players are employees. Kirby is not going to take a reduction in pay that would be equivalent to what an NFL coach mm-hmm. makes versus his roster. That's not happening. So you still have to pay Kirby Smart what you owe him. So you would have kind of, and then you would have new coaches getting hired maybe at lower rates, and it would kind of, the market would get really crazy. So that's one of the big problems, is it's not really set up for that. And I don't know how you would kind of smooth that over and kind of account for the before time and the after time of dealing with that. I don't really know how you would fix that.
You know, as we talk about coaching searches, I was thinking about this the other day too. Look at the amount, like look at the AP poll right now and where the top teams head coaches were just a short amount of time ago. Mm-hmm. Kurt Cignetti is the one, obviously, that is the most prominent discussion here because of what he's done at Indiana. But, you know, there's others. There's Mike Elko, and I'm going to get to my point here in a second. Mike Elko, I would even say Kalen DeBoer at Alabama, Dan Lanning at Oregon, Brent Key at Georgia Tech, mm-hmm. Clark Lee at Vanderbilt, kind of going down the list a little bit more, Joey McGuire at Texas Tech. Let's see here. Venables at OU would kind of fit into this. Mm-hmm. That's everybody for the time being. These are all coaches who are not really well-established coaches, head coaches. These are all people who either they're in their first job and they got that job right before COVID hit mm-hmm. and everything changed, or they got that first job right after all of this happened. And so they stepped in as a head coach and kind of adapted to the world that they were stepping into, opposed to like a Brian Kelly or a James Franklin, who are very set and established in their ways, and maybe they didn't adapt as well as they needed to, mm-hmm. you know, adapt to the new world. And we think about coaching changes. I was talking to you about when Sam Pittman got hired in 2019. You're very much a prisoner of the moment, of like what is working right now. So in 19, that's when LSU was making their run to the national championship. And Ed Ogeron was the quote-unquote CEO head coach. That's kind of what Arkansas did. You hire the guy who you think fits your program, fits your culture, and you say, "Hey, you're going to be our guy at the top." But you know what's going to make you successful is hiring a really good offensive coordinator, hiring a really good defensive coordinator, and then just delegating duties and just making sure that you're a good CEO that overlooks that. Well, now I wonder if there's kind of two schools of thought about what could be successful. Number one, you know, like we were talking about Tony Vitello taking the Giants job, yeah. How a lot of major league franchises want people in there who have not been managers before because they're not going to buck the analytics trend that all of the front offices are putting so much money into. I wonder if college sports now are at a point where you hire someone who does not have those ways that they're going to be set in.
Yeah.
Who, you know, they've shown they can coach and they've shown they can be a good leader, but you're taking a little bit of a gamble on them because they've never been a head coach before. That's number one. And then number two is the, again, Cignetti would fit into this, DeBoer too, the guy who's been really good somewhere kind of down at the lower levels. Everybody's mm-hmm. talking about Bob Chesney right now at JMU as being this guy who's won. And then he moves his way up, and then he wins at that level. Then he moves his way up a little bit more, and he wins at that level. Now he's at the FBS level, and he's winning. I wonder how much either of those two trends influence Arkansas when they make this decision.
Yeah, it's possible. And, I mean, I think when it comes to some of these guys that have gotten fired, I think a lot of times when people are talking about coaches that have been stuck in their ways and have failed to adapt to the new times, they're talking about coaches that have been resistant to NIL. And I don't really think that was the case with Brian Kelly or James Franklin. I don't think that was ever really a problem, that they were having trouble acquiring talent.
James Franklin was resistant to modern offense. I think that was his biggest problem at Penn State.
And so I think, you know, like people point at Dabo Swinney all the time. Yeah. You know, like he wouldn't do the transfer portal. He doesn't want to pay players, blah, 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 blah. You know, like Dave Aranda.
That may be his downfall.
Yeah. And Dave Aranda at Baylor got a bad reputation for not wanting to pay players, to the point where they decided to pay players and then wore T-shirts that said we pay players. So, you know, there's coaches that have been resistant to that, like, pretty explicitly. And that's usually what people mean when they say they haven't adapted. And I don't think we're necessarily seeing that in particular be widespread. But I am so interested, and I've said this before, what the next generation of coach looks like. Because, and I mean people, you know, right now we're talking about people who when they got into coaching, it was a totally different world. And that's not even necessarily people that are that old or have been doing this that long.
Mm-hmm.
There's people that are relatively young who got into this at a time, like long before all of this was going on. I am so interested in, you know, somebody who's a GA somewhere out there right now, or an analyst somewhere right now who's early in their career, who they have been, as long as they've been a coach, this has been the world that they've been in. And in, you know, 20 years when they're, you know, a G5 head coach, or and they're being talked about as a buzzy person for a job, what does this next generation of coaches who have never known anything else, what do they, what does that look like? What are they doing? What are their priorities?
And what does the world look like in 20 years?
Well, yeah, exactly.
are they behind?
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah.
Marcus Freeman would be another one who stepped in during this era and is having a lot of success. You look at the top 10, you do have Kirby Smart in there. You do have Lane Kiffin in there. You do have Ryan Day in there, although Ryan Day is, you know, this is his first head coaching job that he's got at Ohio State. You have some coaches who they clearly have been able to adapt, but for every Lane Kiffin, it feels like there's a lot of coaches who were kind of hot names when Lane Kiffin was kind of making his second coming, so to speak, as a head coach, who they have not been able to, you know, succeed in this era.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting how different it's become and how you kind of have these different sort of groups of coaches as far as, you know, who fits where in this sort of, you know, I hate using the word landscape because everyone always wants to throw around the buzzwords of like the changing landscape of college football. Mm. But like, that's the best word I know how to use.
We could make a whole podcast out of like our least favorite sayings. Like in the preseason, iron sharpens iron.
Oh,
did you ever
God.
Know that?
A couple years ago, it was KJ Jefferson. It was one of KJ Jefferson years. I remember we like started a counter of like how many times players said iron sharpens iron.
The late Bob Hold actually sent us a video of him sharpening one of his knives with a
that's awesome.
With a quote from KJ about
that's
iron
awesome.
Sharpening iron.
Yeah, iron. Hey, I mean, that's what they say. That's what they tell us. It's so funny. There's always something like that. That's like a cliche or like a coach speak thing that just keeps coming up.
Yeah, maybe we can do that next week when there's no football.
Yeah,
we can just
there was one we were talking about recently.
Show.
There was one we were talking about recently that's come up a lot this year, but now I can't remember what it is. But yeah, there's you get trends in those for sure.
All right, appreciate everybody being with us today. Again, we're going to have a show tomorrow at the Hogs Illustrated Sports Club with Matt Hobbs, Nate Thompson, and Bobby Wernas. Again, if you're a baseball fan, I think you're going to want to see that. Looking forward to doing that show. We'll be back here on Friday in the studio to preview Arkansas-Mississippi State further. Appreciate you being with us. Hope that we see you at our website, wholehogsports.com, and have a great day. Stay warm here in wintertime now in Fayetteville.